We're zeroing in on your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Really pleased to have you with us today. And certainly, if you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Oh, it's so nice to be back.
I think we'll start with an email question that we got from
Amy. That sounds great.
Yeah, Amy in Manitowoc says, my poor black dog and every other dog I know is suffering terribly from large numbers of mosquitoes this year. I use a topical which repels fleas, ticks, and mosquitoes. It's Canine Advantix, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. My poor dog's face is still vulnerable. A woman in the dog park yesterday recommended spritzing Listerine over the dog. Or could my dog tolerate skin so soft, dab lightly on their nose and around the eyes?
Well, very good question. In fact, the owner is using one of the appropriate topicals for flea, tick, and mosquito control. There's two on the market that are sold through veterinarians and pet stores, Advantix, and another one called Vectra 3D is the other one that's got slightly different chemical for flea control, but they all contain permethrin, and that's very toxic for cats. So if you're using these products, you got to be careful that your cat and dog don't like to cuddle up together, especially right after application. So we like to keep them separate until the spot is dry, and do not use it on cats, or you could kill your cat. There are topical fly and mosquito repellents that you can get at pet stores that contain a milder version of the synthetic product called permethrin. It's called pyrethrin, and it's, you know, we use it. It used to be something we used for flea control, but it does help with some mosquito control, and it comes in an aerosol can. Some of them come in like a cream or a roll-on as well. And that may help the dog. I do not believe that Listerine would work. In fact, I'd be really concerned about getting it in the dog's eyes. In any of these products, you want to avoid eye contact. My dog, outside this morning, came back in with two big feeding mosquitoes right on the corner of his eye. I mean, and so one of the places where you can't apply anything, and he still managed to get bit there. So you do the best you can, but trying to avoid having them outside during the heavy mosquito time, like early morning or late evening, and do most of your playing outdoors during the day. But with my dogs being bulldogs, in the hot heat of the day, they can't be outside. So, because we worry about heat stroke in those dogs.
Yeah. One other comment before we go to the phones, and that has to do with blue-green algae. Now, we live on Lake Monona, and we've had a couple of those blooms.
Yeah.
And I know to keep, you know, my daughter, well, any of us, out of the water.
Yeah.
In that circumstance, what about dogs?
Well, that's the problem. How do you keep them out of the water? They want to jump in it. They hold the algae on their hair coats. They drink it. We had a family that unfortunately lost one dog, already died before it got into the vet school, and another dog that made it through and ended up being released with supportive care. Both of them were in liver failure at the time. There is an excellent article that answers a lot of these questions. It's actually 11 pages long at the dnr.wisconsin.gov site on blue-green algae. The problems is you can't tell by just looking at the algae bloom whether it's creating the toxins or not. And so even just contact with the skin can cause toxicity, aerosolizing it and breathing it in. So even, you know, for humans, water skiing through the area could cause problems. For pets, drinking it could potentially cause neurotoxicity, liver problems. And it's, you know, I think it's really an underreported disease problem that we see. And it's real important that if you think that the water's contaminated, keep your pet out of it. You know, get them a little kiddie pool. You know, just avoid any of the areas where there's floating material on the surface. It looks kind of blue to green, kind of thick paint-like color. Those would be the times to keep your pet out of the water.
Keeping out of the water. Okay, well, let's go to the phones. And Ray and Stevens Point is up first here. Ray, hello to you.
Thank you very much for taking my call this morning. And thank you for caring about our pets.
Oh, you're welcome.
We just moved to Wisconsin here about 3 years ago and brought our dogs with us from an area that does not have Lyme's disease. And within 2 to 3 months, both dogs had Lyme's disease. We went to the vet, got the antibiotic regimes done. But sadly, both dogs died within a year and a half, and it was not a real pleasant thing for them. And I've always suspected Lyme's because they weren't really old and unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
picked up another dog in the interim, a rescue Springer, just a wonderful animal, that the guy that we got him from said that had been diagnosed with Lyme's by the vet. He was asymptomatic, had been treated successfully, and he had reasons for getting rid of the dog. We took the dog. He's a fine animal, but he's starting to show what I consider the some of the same symptoms mm-hmm. that our previous dogs did, specific lethargy. I take him for a 5-mile walk in the morning, and I have to wait for him when he's at the end of it. He's not keeping up, and this is an animal that should be able to sprint
for
5 or 6 miles without it.
Yeah.
And when I took the dog to the same veterinary clinic, different vet, new vet, who had worked in as an emergency vet in a related clinic, for a period of years, I asked her about giving the dog the vaccine for Lyme's, and she said that in her experience, she had seen a lot of negative consequences to giving the vaccine to dogs that had already had Lyme's and had had the antibiotic regime. And so I went on the internet to research basically what the question is, what's the life expectancy of a dog after they've had Lyme's? And didn't get a good, clean answer. And I'm just wondering if I shouldn't have this dog on long-term therapeutic regime for Lyme's.
Well, I mean, some very good questions. And this is one of these difficult diseases to deal with because there are a lot of asymptomatic pets out there. One of the things that we are, I mean, my standard clinic recommendations for all dogs that live in Wisconsin, even if they're, you know, town dogs that rarely get outside, because we still have deer and mice and so on coming into, the deer are now urban animals and they can carry the deer tick. And there are other tick-borne diseases besides Lyme disease, such as anaplasma is carried by the deer tick as well, and then other tick-borne diseases like Ehrlichia. So practice good tick control using Advantix, Frontline, Vectra 3D. There's a whole host of good flea and tick products out there that you can talk to your veterinarian as to what would be the appropriate one to use on your pet. If you're in a heavy Lyme area, you may want to consider vaccinating. The vaccine that I prefer to use is one that's called the OSPA vaccine, the outer surface protein vaccine. It's very low reaction rate, appears to be helpful. None of the Lyme vaccines are 100% effective, and so you don't want to use that instead of tick control. You need to use both together. And I see when we get a dog that's positive, we start to institute vaccines because obviously the dog is getting exposed and past exposure is not going to protect the dog from future disease. When we do get a positive back on our quick little screen test that's called the SNAP test, we usually send off blood for what's called a quantitative test. It gives you a number to let you know where the dog is in the disease process, because you can have dogs that have very, very low levels that may just be from past infections that were treated successfully, or dogs that are asymptomatic but at high levels that could break with symptoms. And because Lyme affects more than just the joints and causing fever and lameness and lethargy, it can affect the kidneys as well. And that's where we start to see problems with dogs not surviving Lyme disease is when they get the kidney form of it as well. So when we do get a positive Lyme test back, we send off for a quantitative level. It goes to a lab in Colorado. We check kidney values to make sure that the kidneys are working all right. And depending on what comes back on that, we institute therapy. And it's important that you follow up with rechecks, which typically we recheck about 6 months after we go through a round of treatment to make sure that we're, you know, right on track and that we've got the dog treated effectively. So there's a website that you may want to consider going to. The company that makes some of these SNAP tests is called IDEX, I-D-E-X. And if you go to their website, they do have lots of information on Lyme disease that you can follow, and it answers a lot of the questions that you've actually had here. Probably more information than you'd ever want to know. It's designed for veterinarians, but excellent for intelligent owners like yourself.
Ray, thanks a lot for calling, and good luck with your dog. Appreciate it very much. We have lots of people online, so we'll take some more calls. Dan in Superior is up next. Dan, hello.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. I got a puppy and a kitty question.
Okay.
And it all relates to an 8-year-old daughter who's animal crazy. We just got a brand new puppy, 3 days old. Not 3 days. We've had it for 3 days.
Okay.
The Border Collie Alaskan Husky mix.
Okay.
And it's throwing up constantly.
Uh-oh.
And it's
Uh-oh.
Been doing this. And so we have had it into the vet, and one of the things they're considering is it might be a macroesophagus.
Megaesophagus?
Megaesophagus.
Okay, okay.
And a couple questions related. One is if you have anything to add about what I've read about it, and what I'm understanding is there's not much you can do about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the second question related to that would be the ethical side of things. Is this an animal that sometimes gets put to sleep? What is the future of this?
Well, what the esophagus is the tube that connects your mouth, your oral cavity, to the stomach. And it's a muscular tube that helps push the food down into the stomach. And sometimes in some animals, the esophagus, either because there's a ring of tissue trapping it that doesn't allow food to get down, and those are called vascular ring anomalies, or sometimes they're just born with very poor muscle control of their esophagus. The only way to tell would be to take an x-ray of the chest and maybe do a little bit of a contrast study or a swallow study to see where, you know, whether food is pooling in the esophagus or making it down into the stomach at all or not. Some types of megaesophagus are surgically correctable. If it's a little vascular ring that has kind of trapped the esophagus, they can go in. It does mean intrathoracic surgery, so it's a big deal surgery. And ligate the little ring, and you know the esophagus will, in many cases, spring back and go back to normal again. Some of these dogs may be chronically affected. And when you said vomiting, maybe it's just kind of the purist in me as a veterinarian, but vomiting tells me that the dog is actually bringing up stomach contents, that they're actively retching, abdominal contraction. I'm sure everybody that's listened has vomited
right.
one point in their life, and you know what that's like, where you're, you know, up it comes. Versus when we've got a dog with just a dilated esophagus, it's just gravity. So as food builds up in there, they put their head down, it just pours out. And it tends to be food and saliva, no bile, you know, nothing that's been down in the stomach. And it can happen anytime after eating, and it's very passive. The reason why this you need to make this distinction is that a dog that's vomiting, you're going to be working up the stomach. And that could be parvovirus. The dog may have a foreign body in its stomach, swallowed a bone or a toy or something, and you're going to go down that route. If it's the esophagus, totally different way of working it up in treatment.
Sure.
And the risk of dogs with this esophageal problem is that because it's passive, their body doesn't know when this food's going to come up, and they don't close off their airway, and they run the risk of aspirating, actually inhaling food and getting pneumonia. That's what kills these dogs, is not only the fact that they can't get food down on a reliable basis, but they may inhale it and end up with chronic pneumonia,
sure.
and that usually is what causes the problem. So although you've only had your dog for 3 days, I think it's time to go back. If you haven't already done this, it's time to get some special studies done and see what's going on. This dog isn't normal, and 3 days of vomiting definitely requires veterinary assistance.
Okay, and it's actually been weeks. We knew when we got it that it had been sick.
Okay,
so.
Yeah.
Kitty question. We have kittens right now that are being born.
Okay.
I got an 8-year-old daughter that's going to come home, and we've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and one's out and more are coming. What is appropriate for letting her see them?
Oh, well, I think it kind of depends on mom, okay? In fact, if mom is a real social animal, she probably wouldn't mind at all that they've got humans around handling the babies. The more they get handled gently and carefully, and, you know, just being picked up and cuddled and so on, that's going to make them more social later on. And
okay.
so if you want really friendly cats, you know, handling them for 30 minutes plus a day, and it sounds like, you know, your little girl really likes animals, and if she can be gentle and, you know, not rough with them at all and make them have a really good experience, they're going to be much better pets down the road.
If they're only a few hours old, that's okay?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks, Dan. Thank you for calling. And we'll turn to Colleen in West Bend next. And in fact, we'll get to Colleen in just a couple of seconds. I want to remind everybody, our guest today is Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in with a question about your pet's health, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 563-1890 and email us at talk@wpr.org. And now let's turn to Colleen in West Bend. Colleen, thanks for waiting.
Sure. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't have a real serious problem. I just have a dog that likes to chew on me a little bit. He greets me with gently putting his mouth around my hand or my wrist.
Okay.
He moves from room to room with me, tagging along. He kind of bites at me just very gently. Sometimes it hurts a little if my hand bumps into his teeth.
Yeah,
Seems like a
what breed of dog is this?
It's a golden doodle.
Golden doodle. Okay. Puppy or an adult dog?
Year old,
so still a puppy.
Year old in June, yeah.
Yeah, still a puppy. Okay. A couple things that I encourage people to do is always carry something that you can substitute for your flesh. And dogs need to learn bite inhibition, meaning that they need to learn that people are wimps, that we don't have a fur coat, that holding on to us is very different than holding on to a dog playmate that's going to have a fuzzy hair coat and more elastic skin. So if a dog were to put its mouth on me for any reason, especially a puppy, even if it's out of play, a couple things you may want to do. I like to make a sound that sounds like a puppy that's hurt. I'm going to probably blow the producer away here, but go, make a sound like that. Get the dog to immediately back off. You may have just a millisecond of that dog going, huh? What did I do? And substitute something else in their mouth. And that may be, if it's all right with your veterinarian and your dog's chewing needs, a rawhide chip, a toy, something, and then praise it for chewing on the appropriate thing. This is not going to work the first time. The second time, maybe after 20, 30 times, a dog will go, oh, boy, people are wimps. Don't bite on people. Chew on your toy. That's when you get praised and rewarded. And it's just a matter of being consistent. And I mean, if you tolerate it, fine. It's your flesh. But boy, I sure wouldn't want to have that be going on in my house.
Yep. Good luck. Okay. Thanks, Colleen.
All right. Thank you.
Jim and Cudahy, you're up next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 6-year-old Labrador, and he's scratching around his mouth and above the eye, and he's got open sores. Now, I took him to the vet. And the vet said that he didn't have any mites, and I apply ointment to these sores, mm-hmm. and I've given them some antibiotics, but they're not going away. Oh, he's also gotten, he's going to get another second shot for Lyme disease, and I put Foremost on him, and like I say, he's had tests for this mite.
Mm-hmm.
And the vet eliminated mites.
Okay. Yeah. A couple of other things. Very good that your veterinarian did a skin scraping because there is a mite that likes to live in the area around the eye and around the mouth called Demodex. Unfortunately, it's a mite that lives very deep in the hair follicles, and so sometimes it takes doing a very deep, sometimes a little uncomfortable skin scraping to be able to find the mite. And so you squeeze and scrape until you get it actually bleeding and then look under the microscope. And it may take 2 or 3 scrapings before you can actually get a diagnosis. The other things that I would be making sure that your veterinarians looked at is doing some cytology impression smears, which is looked at very differently to rule out whether you're dealing with a yeast or a bacterial infection. Because if it is a bacterial infection or a yeast infection, topical treatments just don't seem to cut it with dogs. They rub the stuff off, they drool, they lick it off, and we're looking at mostly going with systemic or oral therapy, tableted form of medication to get it under control. So going back to the veterinarian and saying, did you do cytology to actually look for infection? If they can't find any organisms, there's some other diseases that are more oddball that can affect the area around the eye and around the mouth that fall into the class called immune-mediated diseases. There's one called pemphigus, pemphigus foliaceus, pemphigus vulgaris, and those are much more serious diseases and sometimes need to be diagnosed via biopsy, which means taking a little piece of the tissue from these areas and sending it off for someone to have a look at it. Even though they've ruled out mites, maybe, depending on how deep they did a skin scraping, if it's not getting better, time to go back. And if they can't figure out what's going on, there are times and places where going to a veterinary dermatologist or a specialist may be in order, and this may be one of them.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Jim. Terry in Brookfield, on to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could address mast cell tumors. I understand there are three types. Mm-hmm. I have a golden that's going in for removal of one tomorrow. It's a confirmation dog, so I'm really concerned.
Okay, yeah.
And from the slide, they couldn't tell if it was a 1, 2, or a 3.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Can you talk about those a little bit, and is there anything that in particular causes them or could inhibit the dog from developing them?
Yeah, well, it's funny that you brought this up, because just this weekend on my bulldog, I noticed a raised red mass on his toe that came up very quickly. And here I'm being the typical owner that's going, I'm not just watching it. It's just that it was not convenient the last 2 days for me to bring him to work with me, and he doesn't sit still for me to do a biopsy at home. And so I'm planning on bringing him in tomorrow to be able to do this. And that's one of the things that's on my rule out list is this a mast cell tumor? When we say mast, it's like the mast of a sailboat, M-A-S-T. Mast cells are a particular type of cell in the body that are involved with allergic response. If you look at them under the microscope, they are filled with all these little granules, and those granules are made up of different vasoactive substances like histamine and things. So that if you get stung by a bee, mast cells are responsible for causing the swelling in that area as you're responding to the toxins, because these mast cells will degranulate and set up that, you know, swelling and inflammatory response. And this is a very common type of tumor in dogs. And unfortunately, there's nothing you can do to prevent them from occurring. It just happens to be one of the more common tumors. And once we've identified a patient that gets these, they may get more of them as time goes on if you're not lucky. I mean, I've had some patients where 5 or 6, 7, 8 later, they're, you know, and they're getting to be, you know, old dogs. And we've operated on all over their body trying to remove these things. The reason why it's important to remove them is that what you see with the mast cell tumor is just the tip of the iceberg. Although they may look very small, they're like an octopus, and they send out tentacles of tissue far beyond what the visible mass is. And so when a surgeon is going to be removing these things, if you've got a preliminary diagnosis that it's a mast cell tumor, we take at least 2 centimeter margins through normal tissue all the way around it. So depending on where that is, it's on his ear. Yeah, it's going to be a real tough place to be able to remove it without doing an ear amputation. But that's why I'm like keeping my fingers crossed that for my dog, it's not his toe, because how can you take 2 centimeters off all the way around? You're not able to grade mast cell tumors on just a needle biopsy or impression smear on its own. You need to do it histologically, and that's where the grade will come after it's removed. Once it's removed, they'll be able to look at how serious this disease actually is. And sometimes if it's a low-grade tumor, surgery is curative and you don't have to do anything. Other times you're looking at radiation therapy, chemotherapy. There's other things that can be done to be able to help some of these dogs. So it's a really nasty spot to have a mast cell tumor. I just ended up having one of my favorite patients lose her life. She was an elderly dog, but had a mast cell tumor on the bottom of her foot, and it was a dachshund, and she could not managed to walk on 3 legs. And so it was not operable, and she ended up losing her life to her mast cell tumor that had spread to regional lymph nodes and the bone marrow and so on. So
now this seems to be shrinking. It's like half the size it was last week. Is that common?
Yeah, because these are made up of these cells that degranulate or release this histamine. That's one of the things you'll see in the history, is that they get bigger and smaller, because if the dog flops its ear or bumps it, the cells that are there are so fragile, they release their little granules. You'll get swelling just like you would with the bee sting, so it gets bigger, and then it gets quiet again. And so sometimes we'll make them look more angry after we've done a biopsy, and then it'll shrink back to its normal size again. So that's one of the things that kind of tells us that's something we need to be thinking about. So it sounds like your veterinarian's right on the ball. A horrible place to have a mast cell tumor, and good luck. I hope that its surgery is going to be curative for your dog. And be on the lookout. Any new lump or bump needs to be biopsied, or at least needle biopsy to get an answer.
Good. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Betty. And we'll turn to Denise in Wisconsin Rapids next. Hi, Denise.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, we had gotten a dog at the Humane Society here in town, and ever since we've had him, he's had problems keeping down his food.
Mm-hmm.
He throws up daily.
Oh.
And the doctor did do a X-ray, and they thought something was in his stomach, but when they opened him up, there was nothing there.
Okay.
And he's still throwing up. There was one day where we thought, well, maybe this is a secret or whatever. He's kind of a counter surfer.
Uh-huh.
So he got into a little bit of grease on the counter, and then he didn't throw up for like 3 days. But then he's back to kind of throwing up again. So.
And what is he throwing up?
Mainly his dog food.
Okay.
And then as the day goes on, it turns into liquid. But he doesn't throw it like when... When we go to work or whatever, when we put him in his crate, he doesn't generally throw up in there.
Okay.
As soon as we come home and he runs around a little bit, then he kind of loses it.
Yeah.
And he does, like, before I can even get over there, sometimes he'll re-eat it again before I can get it cleaned up. I mean, I know he's a dog and he probably...
Yeah.
You know, but...
But that tells me that he's probably not nauseated, because if he vomited and was feeling really gross, he probably wouldn't want to eat it again.
Okay.
And, you know, and again, this is one of these oddball cases where there's so many things that can cause dogs to vomit. If I had a dog that came in that's feeling really good and not having any troubles at all, not losing weight, and blood work was all normal, I would be looking at going through a therapeutic deworming program. I know that sounds kind of odd, but there's a parasite that lives in the stomach that can cause chronic vomiting called Physalopterae, and dogs get it from eating the intermediate host, which are little bugs and beetles. And so dogs eat everything, and that can be a really difficult parasite to diagnose. And sometimes we only find it when we put a scope down into a dog's stomach and actually see the parasite. So it may have been missed when they initially did the gastrotomy to open it up and look for a foreign body, because, you know, you have to be in there almost with a scope to be able to see these things.
Okay.
The other thing that I would do would be trying a couple of diet changes. One would be a low residue diet, meaning low fiber, low fat diet, and see if that makes a difference. Alternatively, I would also be looking at a diet that is a hypoallergenic diet, one that's like a hydrolyzed protein diet. These would be diets you'd have to get through your veterinarian. But if your dog is feeling good, not losing weight, and, you know, nothing else is going on, you may have the luxury of being able to play a little bit. It's too bad that they opened up your dog's stomach. I don't know if they did biopsies, but I always recommend that if you're going to be going in doing anything and the dog's vomiting like this, get pieces of intestine and stomach and biopsy it. Because if he's got something...
Yeah, I don't think he did that.
Yeah, because if he's got inflammatory bowel disease, that's how you're going to diagnose that, is through biopsy. So, you know, I'd hate to send him back to surgery again, but these are some things that you can do to kind of get some things off the table before you jump into the next step again, which would mean, you know, maybe a barium series or gastroscopy, where they actually go in and scope the dog, you know, special GI studies to look at whether you've got bacterial overgrowth or anything like that going on. Usually that's accompanied with diarrhea. So, you know, I think, you know, try those couple of things first, and then it's back to the vet again.
All okay, right. What is the parasite's name again?
Physalopterae. It's a stomach worm that dogs get.
You spell that.
I knew you were going to ask. P-H, Physalopterae. I think, okay, I may not be spelling it right. P-H-Y-S-I-L-O-P-T-E-R-A. Physalopterae, something like that. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Denise. Thank you very much for calling. And Karen in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. Interesting that the previous caller has several experiences with myself and my cat. My one-year-old cat at 4 months old had to be opened up because he was vomiting viciously, and they did do a tissue sample of everything and did find the parasite. There was no bowel obstruction or anything like that, so they did take all the tissue samples. We got the parasite, and we were treated for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's a year old. And every time he drinks water, he sounds like he's trying to throw up a hairball.
Huh.
He can eat food, fine, but when he drinks water, every time he drinks water, he, you know, he has that horrible hairball coughing sound, and nothing comes up. But
wow.
You can tell that something's going on with this only water.
Is he breathing normally at other times, or does he have a voice change or any, like, wheezing or anything like that going on?
None of the above.
Ah. Huh. Very strange. You know, When I hear that he can swallow certain things, you start wondering if he's got some kind of abnormality that is allowing liquids to get passed into his airway, which makes it irritated. Like maybe if his epiglottis doesn't work well, or he's got something wrong with his larynx. The reason why I asked about voice changes is that young cats do get these nasal pharyngeal polyps that can hang in the back of their throat and sometimes interfere with their ability to swallow certain things normally. But it doesn't sound like that's an issue. That's bizarre. That is very bizarre. And I'm sorry I don't have an answer for you. If you ever have your cat in to be sedated for anything, I think a good oral pharyngeal exam is going to be indicated to actually get back in there and look. You never can see a cat's tonsils awake. I mean, it's impossible to get back there. You need to have them knocked out so that you can, you know, actually look at how the vocal folds are moving, whether everything's closing up normally, whether the throat's functioning normally. That might be something to consider, but it is, you know, does involve giving them something to sedate them down.
Yeah.
Right. Well, maybe with the next teeth cleaning or something like
that.
Yeah,
definitely.
Have an exam done.
Good.
Yep. Good luck. Thanks, Karen, for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's turn to Carl in Madison next. Hi, Carl.
Howdy. Dr. Sandy, I've got a simple problem if I had only one cat, but when I adopted two cats a year ago May, 1 8 and one a little under two right now, I obviously had two cats. And one of them, I panicked and took to the vet because I thought he had a tumor, and she says, no, he's just fat.
Okay.
So I've been pretty good at Googling stuff, but I cannot find... And I've tried many, many times to figure out how can you, when you got two cats, and one's a glutton, he was kind of starved when he was a kitten.
Yeah.
And he's a bit of a glutton, and now he's way overweight. And I've changed their food to really high-quality food and blah, blah, blah. How do you put one on a diet?
Oh, good question. And this comes up so often. If the cat that's overweight is physically challenged because of his weight, you can feed the younger cat up on places like on top of the refrigerator, on top of the kitchen cabinets, where they can get up, but the fat cat can't.
No,
and that might
no.
be nope. That's not going to work. Okay.
No, he's actually got a gimp leg, but he's
pretty agile when it comes to food.
He can run and jump and leap and yeah. Boy, it's amazing.
Well, it comes down to two things. One, even though it may not be what the cats consider ideal. Meal feeding them, where you put food down maybe 2 to 3 times a day, and they get their regulated portion that is figured out how many calories they need a day, and you divide it up and give them their own meal, and that way he gets what he needs, the slender cat gets what they need, and they just eat like we feed dogs. And that's, although cats don't see the humor in that period, you know, they like to just nibble all day long, they can be trained to be meal fed, but it does take more hands-on from the owner. Alternatively, I had a vet student that graduated last year that had a wonderful idea. She went out and bought one of these big plastic storage tubs that's kind of translucent that lets light in but has a lid that snaps on. Big enough that it could hold, you know, a fairly good size, hold a cat and a food dish. And then she also bought, they make these little cat doors that the cat that is allowed to go through the door wears a collar with a little magnetized key on it. So as they approach, it's kind of like my little key guard that I use to be able to get around the clinic where the doors are locked and I have to flash my key card to be able to get through a door. As the cat approaches this little cat door, it allows the cat to go in. She mounted the magnetized cat door on the plastic storage tub and puts the cat's food in there. The cat can go in and out willy-nilly all day long. The fat cat just sits there and outside the plastic tub because it's not wearing the collar and drools and carries on and wants to get at the food but can't get at it. So that way the skinny cat can nibble all day long, and the fat cat was regulated with just being fed certain amounts of food per day to meet its caloric needs. Cost her a little bit of money. I think the door and the collar and the box itself was about $50. So there you go. That might be something to consider.
That's reasonable. On your first suggestion, do you have to feed them in two totally separated locations?
It depends on your cats. I have one friend that has three cats, and he actually has to sit with one cat and guard the food because the other two finish up first. And poor little George doesn't get his food if the other ones can get it. So he has to stand guard and make sure the other cats stay away.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. All right. That's a great idea.
I know.
Though.
I know. I for a cat door. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that idea. Jay and Holman, your turn now. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Larry. How are you? And Sandy, it was a pleasure meeting you guys at your party a couple weeks ago.
That was fun. Yeah.
A lot of fun.
My question regards the proper time to take a puppy from the mother if you're buying it from a breeder. And we're in a situation where we have the fourth choice of a litter of eight English setters.
Okay.
And so after the first three are selected, which is going to be at exactly 8 weeks,
okay,
we sort of have an opportunity here to stall it off if it's better for the dogs to be with the mother a little bit longer, although the breeder keeps the mother away from him during the day when he's away because their teeth harming her.
Right, right. 8 weeks is a perfect time to be able to get a puppy. And so if you can get the puppy at that point, that's perfect. That gives you a big window of opportunity for socializing, starting very early training, getting them used to things in your house, you know, and I think that's perfect. The big problem is if you wait longer, then if the puppy is maybe you've got kids that you want to have the dog exposed to, and at the breeder's place there are no children, so the dog may not know who, you know, little kids are, or cats or other dogs besides English setters. So perfect opportunity for you to get the dog would be at this age.
Doing frivolously marvelous with adult cats.
Okay.
So that's a great thing. We visited this litter three times, so that's going good. Let me try one other thing on. We bicycle and have a carrier, and how soon do we introduce them to that, and do we do it, put them in, take them out, and gradually work up to it? Or
what kind of carrier? One that pulls behind your
bicycle?
Yeah,
the kind that are designed for children? With the child seat removed. And
What a great idea. Yeah, I used to do that with my Yorkie, although there was a kid in there too. And so the two of them would ride together. And, you know, I think, again, you're going to have to go about it very slowly, because this is going to be, and I'd maybe put the puppy in there and just let it, without it being even hooked to a bicycle, just allow the puppy to go in and out, and it's unzipped, and the dog learns that going in there is fun, because guess what? I find little bits of doggy beef jerky or bits of hot dog or whatever. I love going in there. Then you can gradually put them in, let them have a snack while you zip it shut, and then maybe just manually pull it a little bit while the dog's, you know, having a good time. Lots of praise, jolly them up. Hook it to a bike, down the driveway and back. And, you know, you just don't want the dog to panic and get scared when it's in there. So start slow. You got lots of time. And the dog should be a very active rider soon, I hope.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Jay.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. And thanks for coming to our event here a couple of weeks ago. That was a lot of fun. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here, and I'm really glad to have you listening in. And before we go back to the phones, I wanted to make you an invitation to come with me to the Peninsula Players Theater in Door County. We have a live broadcast on July 24th. The Peninsula Players Theater in Door County is a beautiful theater. And we're going to have a lot of fun. We'll do a live show there. We hope you can come a little early so we can chat a bit beforehand. We'll be doing some shows kind of relating to Door County a little bit. I'm sure we'll be talking about Door County cherries. I love Door County cherries. And some other things as well. And that's Thursday, July 24th. And if you're in the Oshkosh, Appleton, or Green Bay areas, we're hosting a shuttle bus with pickups in Oshkosh, Appleton, and Green Bay to help you get to the broadcast if you want to go that way and save some money on the gas and so forth. You can do that. There are tickets. You have to get tickets for the shuttle bus and so forth. And to find out more, you can call, give you a number here to call. It's 920-465-2502. I'll repeat that again. It's 920-465-2502. And you can also go online to WPR.org and then /in Door County. WPR.org/Door County. Again, it's Thursday, July 24th. We're looking forward to getting to the Peninsula Players Theater. Oh, and afterwards, you can enjoy a fish boil with myself and Emily and Renee, daughter and wife, will be along too. So we'll be doing a fish boil right after the show. So it should be a lot of fun on July 24th. And again, the phone number, 920-465-2502. Or just go online to wpr.org/DoorCounty. And now we'll go back to the phones, and Diana in Monona is up next. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hello.
I have one of our kitties has blood in her stool. We just noticed it about 3 days ago because she happened to go outside the litter box, and I noticed it when I was cleaning it up. What kind of things can cause that?
Normal stool, though, not diarrhea?
No, just regular stool.
Normal stool. It could just be that she had a bulky stool that caused a little rectal tear or something, and it's nothing serious. It could be that she had a lot of hair or, like, plant material, if she eats a lot of plant material, that caused a little bit of roughness. And again, same thing, maybe absolutely nothing. If she's an indoor-outdoor cat, we do worry about things like intestinal parasites that can cause problems and bleeding sometimes, too. So getting a stool sample checked by your veterinarian would be in order. And so you can take in a stool sample and have that looked at for intestinal parasites, although there are some that are difficult to diagnose on a standard fecal flotation. Tapeworms are one. And so if your pet is an avid hunter, we get, you know, concerned about that. And we'd probably want to just go ahead with a deworming program that would treat something like tapeworms as well. So have a stool sample checked. You know, just watch what your cat's eating. Do lots of grooming. If it's persisting, then you jump to the next step, which may mean, you know, some GI studies or diet changes and things too.
She's been we do let them go outside, and they do graze on the grass quite a bit.
Yeah.
We keep them on a halter so they don't get loose.
Yeah. So if she's been eating a lot of those, you know, really like grass blades that are nice and sharp, that could have been what caused the problem.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling.
Common things are common and uncommon things aren't, you know? There you go.
All right. Danette in Eau Claire, we turn to you now. Hi, Danette.
Hello. My brother is a constant rescuer of kitties, and he rescued a cat that is now at our house, staying away from our other kitties. And she took a trip to the vet yesterday, and he said she looked pretty healthy and no feline leukemia, no FIV. They're running the whole blood stuff yet, so they haven't gotten back to me on those results. But she is having seizures. Yesterday was the day that we brought her home into the vet. She had one in the car. She had two that I saw, and they're loud and thrashing enough that she'll knock over the water dish.
She'll make
a mess, and she'll lose her urine.
Yeah.
In the process, she spits a lot when she's doing this. However, she is using her litter box.
Okay.
You know, I saw some stool in her litter box. She knows how to use that. And, of course, when she waits in there, it lasts between 20 and 30 seconds. And you can't touch her at all because,
I've
experienced some scratches.
Yeah.
And the main concern for me is that, well, we've got the other two cats. With her losing that urine, that's the first sign. She'll become rigid, like if you're holding her. She'll lose her urine, and then she'll start the convulsions, and they're pretty violent. I mean, the legs are kicking, the head is
very scary to see.
Very violent. They're very violent seizures.
Yeah.
And I guess my main concern is you know, do I want to see if I want to do a medication that could control that? I know that a lot of those are very sedating. Do I want to sedate my kitty? Or if there's anything I can do. She is changing food now. My brother was feeding her the cheapest cat food he could find, of course, and we make our own cat food for our cat. And a little concerning for me.
I can see why you're concerned. It's very scary to see an animal have a seizure. Well, first of all, they don't swallow their tongues. And the best thing you can do is just, one, protect yourself and make sure that they're not near any stairs, sharp objects, anything where they can hurt themselves. And just let them ride it out. Unfortunately for cats, we see in dogs very commonly epilepsy where we can't find an underlying cause for it. In cats, many of the cats that are epileptics or seizuring like this have some underlying cause, such as infectious diseases like FIP that can affect the brain. Feline leukemia, you said, was negative, but sometimes we'll still see things like brain tumors and so on that can cause problems. Fungal infections. I mean, it's unlikely that it's anything affecting her liver or her kidneys, but, you know, getting full blood work done to make sure that she doesn't have like a vascular shunt from her liver, that she's not hypoglycemic.
Okay.
And, you know, going through that whole infectious disease testing, complete blood work, rule out metabolic causes and try to rule out to the best of your ability infectious diseases, then you're looking at how far you want to take it from there.
Right.
The next step would be a visit with a veterinary neurologist for an MRI, a magnetic resonance imaging study of the brain, and perhaps a cerebral spinal fluid tap to, you know, see if they can find any abnormalities that need to be treated differently. Alternatively, if they find nothing, then you're looking at, well, treatment. And sometimes owners just elect to treat rather than going through all the diagnostics. I get a little concerned with this cat being introduced into a household as a new cat with other cats if she does have something like FIP, which is feline infectious peritonitis, which stands for something like inflammation in the intestinal tract area, but it can be in the brain as well.
She's only a year old.
Yeah.
She's not been spayed yet.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And she's relatively young, and that's why I guess that was my main concern. I know I've had cats.
Yeah.
You know, as they've gotten older, have developed.
Well, it's important to get her spayed because estrogen can lower the seizure threshold, and she could be seizuring worse when she's in heat. And you know, cats are in and out of heat all the time during the summer and spring, summer, and fall. So it's important to get her spayed. She's going to be a little bit more of an anesthetic risk because there's certain drugs that you can't use if she's an epileptic. So this would be something your veterinarian would obviously have to be aware of. But when it comes to treatment, I mean, if she's having this many seizures, she really would benefit from some type of an anticonvulsant drug. And for the first couple of weeks, and the drug that we typically use for cats is phenobarbital. They tolerate it well. They may be a little sedated for the first week or two, but then their body gets used to it, and they you rarely see any change in their personality unless you need to go on really high doses to keep the seizures under control. But yeah, so it sounds like you're starting to do some of the workup, but wait till you get the rest of the lab work back, get her spayed, and one thing that I always recommend my students to do, and maybe your veterinarian has done this already, get a good look at the eyeballs. They're the window of the nervous system. And so if they haven't...
And he said the eyes looked wonderful.
Good. So
wonderful.
They did a good retinal exam. They actually dilated her pupils and had a look at her retinas and ruled out whether there was anything back there, because some infectious diseases can affect the retinas as well.
The eyes. Yeah. And I guess the second part of this is we weren't sure if we were going to be keeping her. My brother's got four cats right now, and then he moved, and he's got these four cats, so we were going to have to, you know, give them up for adoption, which I don't like doing. But how adaptable is a cat who's having these problems? Will she just be put down? Will
to adapt it? Good question. I mean, there are some good Samaritans out there that would take this cat, but this is cat season right now, and in fact, the Humane Society, our local Humane Society, I just saw an ad in the paper that free scratching post with every cat adoption. I mean, they are so desperate to find homes for all the cats that are healthy cats, adoptable cats out there, that they're willing to give away, a scratching post, which can be quite expensive. So I worry about this cat's life if she does get put into a situation where she requires extensive medical management.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Sandy, you were telling me about a website, Why Your Vet is Best website.
Oh, thank you. This is a website that's called thankyourvet.org. And it's all one word, Thank Your Vet. Okay. And it's sponsored by Morris Animal Foundation and Hills Pet Food. And they have a contest where they want people to nominate their vet for Vet of the Year. And, you know, and it's a really easy thing to do. And I'm hoping, I want to see one of my vet students that I've taught become the Midwest Vet of the Year and then maybe go on to win the National Nationals. And the prize is a nice prize. It's sent, they send you out to the Western States Veterinary Conference in Las Vegas, all expense paid. But it's if you go to that website, thankyourvet.org, and you'll find that site. It's also associated with the Morris Animal Foundation website as well. And
so what is this, 250 words or less?
Yeah, 300 words or less, why your vet is the best in America. You know, outstanding care and treatment of animals, commitment to human-animal bonds, service to the community, and devotion to the veterinary profession. And I really want to, I mean, that would be so great. It would make me feel so good to see one of my students nominated. Yep.
I think that's a great idea. And it's
thankyourvet.org.
Thankyourvet.org.
And you have to have this sent in by August 31st. So they're not accepting them after midnight on August 31st.
Well, I tell you what, that's a great idea. And we've got lots of pet lovers who listen to the show, especially on a day like today.
Yeah.
So get your creative juices flowing out there and go to thankyourvet.org. Dr. Sandy Such, a clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Looking at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. And Sandy, the Swiss have, you've been telling me, have some interesting laws relating to animals.
It really is. And I don't think I'd want to be a cat in Switzerland, but we'll get to that in a second. If you own a dog, and I think these are really good ideas. If you own a dog, you're required to take two classes, one on just general health care and a class on like training classes. So you have a dog that walks well and is socially, you know, going to fit into society well. If you're a fisherman like with catching fish on hooks, you have to take a class on humane fish catching and release. And, you know, if you've, even if you're a fish owner at home with an aquarium, there's certain regulations that you have to have. It's even illegal to flush a fish down the toilet there. If it's an ill fish, you have to humanely kill it with certain chemicals. I don't know how they're regulating that. You know, how do they trace the fish back? Who knows? But if you're a cat, unfortunately, it is still legal to kill a cat and skin it and sell the fur, the pelt, for commercial trade. So it's still legal to take cat's skin, but you have to take, you have to humanely kill your fish with the euthanasia fluid. So go figure. Every country's different, and just maybe something to think about if you have a cat that's, you're letting roam on the streets of Switzerland. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, on that note, we'll turn to some callers here at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Annika is next in Cedarburg. Annika, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, Larry and Sandy. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
About a little over a week ago now, I had to put down my lab. He was eight years old, and he was very, very healthy up until about a week before his death. He was the center of my world. I mean, we walked about 8 miles a day together. He ate all the best food, and I had him at the vet for all his regular checkups and heartworm and everything. My question is, he died of lymphatic cancer, and it struck him like a freight train. I mean, one night he had bumps on his neck, and within a week he couldn't walk around the block, and he had bumps all over his body. You know, I've read some stuff online, and I know it's sort of a mysterious cancer, but is this genetic? Is it something I did raising him? I've heard there's some connections. People are questioning like heartworm medication. Do you know anything about this?
Well, my own dog, I had a collie named Barney who had a very similar type story. He died very quickly of lymphoma, very fulminant. Usually they don't go that quickly. It is one of the types of cancer that we regularly treat at the veterinary school with various chemotherapy protocols. As to what the cause of it is, your guess is as good as mine. We do, you know, just it happens in middle age to older dogs. You know, you may want to be looking at the family history of the dogs that you're buying as to what killed mom and dad and siblings or whatever. And, you know, maybe just see if there's something that runs in the family. But, you know, it's blaming heartworm preventative or something else. Everyone's always looking for, you know, what could I have done differently? Yeah. And it's the old, you know, the guilt of, could I have you know, detected this earlier? Could I have treated it? What would I have done? And you did everything you could. You were feeding him a good diet. He got lots of exercise. It's, you know, the overweight dog that's on a poor diet that has a higher risk of getting cancer. So, you know, you were doing everything in your power to keep him as healthy as you could. And it's just one of those very unfortunate things that, you know, good things sometimes happen or bad things happen to good dogs. And I'm so sorry for your loss. And I know how hard it can be because it's, you know, it hits you like you said, like a freight train. I mean, it's one day you have him and the next day you don't. And it really changes your world, especially when he's been your companion for so long. And, you know, all I can suggest is, you know, get involved with a grief support group. I know we've got grief counselors at the veterinary school. Your veterinarian may be able to help you with getting in touch with somebody if you feel that it would be helpful to talk with an individual or with a group. Take your time if you're thinking about getting a companion animal, because obviously this dog left a very big collar to fill, and getting another dog right away because you've got that empty spot in your heart could backfire, because you may make the wrong choice and pick the wrong dog for you. So take your time, grieve, get to the point where you're, you know, able to look at all the good times you had together and then think about moving on. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Sorry for your loss, Annika.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Yeah, sometimes it's...
I know.
No matter what you do.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, like that. Like I said, my dog Barney, same thing. It was very, very quick.
Well, Julie in Palmyra, we turn to you next. Hi, Julie. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I love your program.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about my little girl that I got. I've had her for 18 days. She's a 7-year-old golden retriever, and she had been a breeding dog that lived in a kennel all of her life. And so it's like picking her up and putting her on Mars and saying, live a totally different life. She's not used to going in the house or cars or anything like that. And I'm having a really hard time getting her to eat.
Okay.
When I got her, she weighed 82 pounds. So she was, and I couldn't feel her ribs or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So she was overweight. They had been feeding her Old Roy Puppy Complete or something like that. And I even broke down and bought some of that food to see if I could tempt her with that, which I would not normally feed my dog.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get her to eat any of that. And I tried mackerel and liverwurst and, I mean, human food that I don't normally feed my dog either, but just something to get her to eat. I finally, she's on a Canidae senior formula.
Okay.
Canned. It's the only thing I can get her to eat, and if I can get her to eat a whole can a day, she's having a good day.
Yeah.
So she has obviously lost weight since I've had her. From when I took her into the vet the first day that I got her, and then I took her in like 6 days later, she had lost 5 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
I have not had her back in and had her weighed since then. I'm now starting to feel her ribs. I mean, they're not protuberant or anything. And she's happy. She's smiling. She's wagging her tail. She loves, I get the leash out and she is just tearing around the yard. She loves going for walks.
Well,
so we're doing that on a regular basis. And I also got a 6-week-old puppy last week.
Okay.
Last Friday. And he actually seems to be helping her as far knowing that toys can be played with and stuff like that. And
sounds like you're really giving her a good life. And, you know, when we have a dog that doesn't eat, the things that you need to do is, first of all, you know, is this just a behavioral problem? Is she expecting, like, a dinner show with her dinner? Because some dogs, they want to, you know, be hand-fed and have the owner sitting there with them. Some of them like to eat out of certain bowls in a certain location. I have a rescue bulldog that only eats in her crate. And so I have the crate door open, and she runs in there, and that's where she likes to eat. I mean, if the food was elsewhere, she probably would eat it, but that's her preferred place.
Uh-huh.
So contacting the previous owner to just find out What was the ritual involved with mealtime? And, you know, what kind of dishes did maybe she ate on flat bowls, like flat, like cookie sheets, or, you know, some other type of dish, like a plastic bowl versus stainless steel, and maybe her tags are banging on it and it's scaring her. So try to piece together what it was like before. So it may mean calling the person and finding out. The other thing we want to do is, you know, rule out, is there a medical problem here? She's a middle-aged female dog.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether she's spayed or not yet. You know, has
she is not spayed yet. Yeah. And they did, you know, blood work and found out that her thyroid is good. I took a stool sample in.
Mm-hmm.
And they had thought she might have colitis.
Yeah.
Because at first she was having kind of bloody, mucousy stool.
Mm-hmm.
And very loose. And it's now starting to be more formed, and I took it in to have that checked, and that all came back good.
And, you know, the fact that she came from a kennel, though, just because you've checked a stool sample doesn't mean that it's negative for parasites. The two biggies that can really make a dog sick and not feel well are Giardia and whipworms, and they're very difficult to eradicate from a kennel situation. And in fact, when they've done studies of dogs that have come from group situations, they find that about a third of the puppies coming from kennel situations are positive for Giardia, looking at Giardia statistics. So getting your dog, even though it was negative, when we look at, you know, treating a dog with colitis symptoms, one of the things we do is just therapeutically treat them with an anthelmintic, usually something like fenbendazole and metronidazole, to get rid of any potential parasites that are there. And I think that that needs to be done. But
okay.
I'd also go back to your veterinarian. It could be that she's got like a low-grade uterine infection, that she's maybe, you know, had a heat cycle and is now in mm-hmm. false pregnancy, and it's affecting her emotional state. There's a number of things that way that, you know, need to be looked into to make sure that we're not letting something medically go. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So I take her back to the
Take her back in and just say, you know, she's got a really poor appetite. What do you think? And
mm-hmm.
they may need to do, you know, some more testing on her.
Okay.
Good luck.
Well, thank you for your help.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Alan in McHenry, Illinois, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for calling my call. Dr. Snoddy, I just have a quick question in my, my black lab here. He was diagnosed late last year with diabetes, and they tried to adjust his insulin. I've been giving him a shot twice a day. First thing, the vet told me to give him an NPH,
mm-hmm.
Which is a long-acting insulin, and I've been giving him, they've been adjusting it. Now he's like in a 22 units twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking to the internet, and I'm a nurse, and the most common insulin that we've been giving to the patient right now is Lantus. So I suggested that into my vet, and he said he never heard anything about Lantus at all.
Well, that's glargine insulin, insulin glargine.
Right.
We do use that in cats very commonly. We do not use it in dogs.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not an internist. But they're, you know, the insulin that we typically use in dogs is called Vetsulin is one of them that happens to be used. And it's, you know, but is your dog well regulated? Most dogs do need twice daily insulin, no matter what the type of insulin is.
Uh-huh.
It's very common. Do you have your dog on a special diet? Are they on like the diabetes diet, like the DCO diet? Or
no, actually, I've been giving him this Iams that I saw that they advertise like controlling blood sugar. I don't know how effective that is, though.
Yeah, you really need to be looking at a therapeutic diet that is made for dogs that are diabetic. And it's usually, just like with people, sometimes a higher... this is different for cats. Cats have different needs for handling their diabetes, but a high fiber diet to kind of slow down glucose absorption, and that seems to help regulate them a little bit better, and it also helps get their weight under control. So, you know, looking at diet, and, you know, if your dog is doing fine and you've been in for glucose curves and everything's going fine, I'd say stay with the insulin that you're on.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Also, I've kind of, like, noticed pretty recently that he's been, like, not seeing things, like bumping on things and stuff like that. And I look into his eyes, and it looks like there's like shadows.
Dogs and cats that are unregulated diabetics will develop
cataracts.
And so if his diabetes isn't poorly regulated, he may be getting deposits in his lenses. And so that's mm-hmm. a good indication that it's time to go back and have his sugar levels rechecked and maybe his insulin levels, you know, tweaked to make sure that he's on the right level of insulin.
And he also developed some sores on his elbows.
Okay.
Is that pretty common for a diabetic?
Well, anytime you've got an animal that's diabetic, they are more prone to infections. Urinary tract infections, they may take longer to heal. If he's not feeling great and he's spending a lot of time laying down, they can get bed sores, or if they've got like elbow issues and he's spending a lot of time down on his elbows, they can take a lot longer to heal. There is a company, though, that makes these elbow pads for dogs, and they're called Dog Legs, D-O-G-L-E-G-G-S, I think, something like that.
Something
but if you look
that.
Up like doglegs.com, they custom make elbow pads for dogs. And so if you've got a dog with, you know, kind of tender elbows, that might be something to consider getting.
All right. And he's one last question. I've noticed that, you know, he's been drinking a lot of water. And he's having like excessive urination. Is that pretty common?
That's definitely a sign of an unregulated diabetic.
Okay.
So the fact that he's got non-healing sores, urinating more, drinking more, and you're seeing cataracts, he needs to go back in.
All right. Would a surgery for cataracts be... Would you recommend that for...
They do lens replacement surgery, but I would be recommending that he gets his diabetes regulated before you start anesthetizing him and doing surgery. Yeah.
Good luck.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. And let's turn to Mindy next in Madison. Hi, Mindy.
Hi. I have a 5-year-old cat. She was adopted from the Humane Society, and over the years she's passed hands a lot within a small group. She's had a lot of owners. A couple of years ago, I took her, and she's always been great as far as litter training has went. I mean, I've never had any problems that way. Until the beginning of June, and she has started urinating and defecating. She's even backing up to things and spraying to them. And she was spayed when she was, you know, 5-6 months old. I've never seen this before. And she's also always been perfectly content indoors, but she's taken to bolting out of the house. We have to open the door so carefully, and she's just never behaved this way before.
Are there other cats hanging around outside?
None that we've noticed.
And do you have other cats in the house, or is she the only cat? She's the
only
cat. How many litter boxes do you have?
She's got one.
Okay. And is it covered or open pan?
It's covered.
Covered. Okay. I'm going to go through Sawchuk's rules of litter boxes for cats, okay? But before I do that, first thing you need to do is get her into a veterinarian. It seems like I'm a broken record. Get him into the vet. Get him into the vet. But you need to make sure that there isn't an underlying medical problem, such as, you know, this usually isn't in 5-year-old cats. It's usually older cats. But hyperthyroidism can cause personality change. And when the thyroid gland is overactive, I've seen some cats start to urine mark for that reason. If there's, you know, she's got any other, you know, problems such as, you know, urinary tract infection or something that's bugging her, she may have developed a healthy superstition around the litter box. It's like, I go there, it hurts, so I'm going to start going elsewhere.
Okay.
So rule out medical problems first, which would mean maybe some blood work, a little urine test. And if everything comes back clean, then you have to start going back to square one when it comes to litter box management. And here's what I tell people that need to be done with litter boxes. And again, there's, you know, there's going to be some variability according to the cat's wishes as well. But a litter box for every cat plus one. So what does that mean? You have one cat, at least two litter boxes in two separate locations in your home. You don't want them side by side. That'd be like building your dream home and putting two toilets in the same bathroom. It just doesn't serve the family a lot of good. And uncovered. Covered boxes are like the worst porta potty on a hot summer day at the state fair. Okay. So they it holds odors. They can't move in it. They sometimes feel trapped. And although covered boxes are convenient for us, a lot of cats don't like them. So adding in a box or two, a couple more without covers on them is going to be important. No liners in the box. Cats get their claws caught in them. They're a little slippery. It's kind of like us using those tushy protectors in public restrooms, you know, very comfortable. So, and then using the right litter that the cat likes, preferably soft, scoopable, sandy type litter that's unscented, that you will go in there daily and scoop the litter out at least preferably twice a day if you've got a cat with a problem. And so I always ask ask people how often they flush their own toilet. And so, you know, it's like, you know,
same difference.
Yeah, same thing. You need to have clean facilities for your cat. Can't be located near anything that's like equipment, like a water softener or a washing machine, not in high traffic areas and not near where she eats. And, okay. You know, so try to, you know, be looking at your house. Where can I put these other litter boxes? So like in my house, I have a litter box actually in my attached garage because my cats like to go out there. I have a litter box in my office. And the worst place to have a litter box that my cats don't seem to mind is in kind of my furnace storage room. And I've got actually two litter boxes in there. So that seems to serve my cats well. Yeah, it's not ideal to have a litter box in my office, but, you know, it gets me cleaning it all the time because I never want to have it dirty.
Right.
And so those are kind of the rules that you want to go by. And
okay.
And hopefully they won't, they'll, you know, it'll solve your kitty's problem. But
hope so.
Yeah.
Okay. As far as the medical possibilities, as far as eating and drinking and, any stool or anything that way, mm-hmm. everything's continued to be normal. But she's a big cat.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily that, you know, I don't give her free choice feeding. You know, she gets about half a cup in the morning and at night because she likes to always have something there.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's relatively active, but she's a really big cat. I mean, could her weight be connected with any particular problem?
It can be. She could be diabetic. We know that obesity is related to diabetes, causes diabetes in cats. So that may be part of it. It may be that just she's a big cat and she doesn't like the covered box. And she may have accepted it for the first year or so you had her and then has just said, I've had enough of this and I don't like it anymore because I can't fit in it. So that could be part of the problem, too.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, she's gotten bigger, but it's the one that she's had when I got her. They brought along her things.
So. Yeah.
But okay. All right. Well, thank you for your help.
Good luck.
And your suggestions.
Okay.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
A lot for calling. And Daryl in Middleton, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 4-year-old female golden retriever. She's in really great physical shape, not at all overweight. She gets lots of exercise. Mm. She's not anxious, but when we play a certain kind of play, primarily with balls,
mm-hmm.
she starts to look like she's panicking.
Huh.
And I've talked to lots of folks about this, and she's not at all the hyper dog that.
What makes you think she's panicking?
Well, she. She starts to pant quite a bit, and she runs around looking for corners to hide in. She tries to climb up on top of us like she would if something had frightened her.
Well, the easiest answer to this would be, don't do it anymore, okay?
Yeah.
If she gets turned off by this, it may be something you're going to have to find other toys to play with or other methods of playing with her. Maybe she's had a bad experience. Like I had a dog, my own dog got hit in the head with a baseball that somebody hit a grounder and hit the dog, knocked it out. And that dog, and if it would see a ball, would panic too. So it could have been something like that could have happened that you didn't even know about. So just I'd say, you know, there's lots of other things you can do with your dog that don't involve it getting upset.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Simple answer. Yeah.
And thank you very much for calling. And Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You'll be back in a month.
I will be.
And we'll do this all over again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Coming up tomorrow, Doug Beagie of Madison talks about his new book on the American chestnut tree. And then Donna Lotzer comes by from the UW-Madison Poison Control Center to talk with us about avoiding poisons. And then I wanted to mention once again that Thursday, July 24th, we'll be broadcasting from the Peninsula Players Theater in Door County. Have a fish boil afterwards. If you want to pick up a shuttle bus and ride with some other Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, and you're in the Oshkosh, Appleton, or Green Bay areas, we'll be hosting a shuttle bus to those areas as well. For tickets, call 920-465-2502. That's 920-465-2502. Or just go to wpr.org/Door County and you'll get some information there as well. Thank you very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.